Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how cartel extortion in Mexico is driving up prices in the U.S.
And how a local band uses hard rock to express tender emotions.
But first, Arizona has given out the first credits under a new state program aimed at turning some farmland into housing. Lawmakers and the governor created the Ag to Urban program earlier this year. It allows agricultural users in areas where groundwater use is restricted to sell their water rights to developers. The idea is that homes use less water than do farms, so the state saves water but also helps deal with its housing shortage. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk is with me now to talk more about this. Good morning, Cameron.
Hi.
So let's start first off with what exactly this Ag to Urban program does. Like, how does it work?
Well, it's a voluntary program. So any farmers who want to participate essentially have the option to sell their land and their water allocation to developers for housing. So like you said, it's meant to be kind of a win-win situation for the farmers, at least if they want to make money instead of continuing to farm,
right?
Which is following the trend of agriculture really declining in Maricopa County over the past several decades.
Right.
And then, of course, we get to increase the housing supply. And this is very much a story about growth and the need from the business community and housing community to continue growing the valley.
Well, and to be clear, like, no farmer is being forced to sell. This is entirely voluntary?
Yes. Entirely.
Okay. So where is this new project? Like, where were these first credits allocated?
This particular project is going to be out in Buckeye, and I believe it's for about 820, 825 new houses.
Okay.
Which is a decent sized project. It's about the size of, a subdivision that you would see out here. So this is, according to ADWR, I think probably just the beginning. They said there are other projects in the pipeline waiting for approval. When this was first announced, the Ag to Urban legislation, Hobbs, the governor, and other lawmakers were saying, well, this could be the way we get tens of thousands of new homes in places like Buckeye and also in Pinal County. So it remains to be seen because it, like we talked about earlier, it's contingent on how many people choose to participate in the program. There's no mandates. So it could be the start of, those tens of thousands of new homes, or it could be just a few projects in the pipeline.
And it's interesting to note that Buckeye is one of those areas where, by and large, new development was stopped, right, when Governor Hobbs first came into office because of concerns about the water supply.
Yeah, the groundwater supply in particular, because in Phoenix we have groundwater protections. We're in what's called an active management area. And early in the Hobbs administration, they released this report showing that groundwater levels are actually a little low. And because of that, they put on a development moratorium until developers could, through interesting means, prove that they had the water supplies to build. And this is a way for them to do that. This is a way to get around that.
What do we know about the other applications out there? Like, do we know where they are or how many homes they might be proposing?
Nope, next to nothing. They haven't really released it yet. But I've heard it's around the, like, five-ish number rather than the thousands number in terms of how many applications we're considering.
Okay. And it would be interesting to see, and, when they come out, and assuming that they are approved by ADWR, to the point about, like, could this be tens of thousands of homes, or is this going to be, maybe a few thousand homes? Like, any amount helps, but obviously the state is hoping for a pretty big number here.
Right. It's an interesting dance, the housing to water supply, because you have to have water, you have to have housing, you can't have housing without water. And our water supply fluctuates, right? And so water is always a topic of conversation, whether it's the Colorado River supply or the groundwater levels changing. And, these developers have to prove, this development is going to have enough water for a century. And I know that for a fact. And I can back that up. And it's going to be great. And you have to be like, okay, sounds good.
Okay. So as I mentioned, Cameron, this was a piece of legislation approved during this year's legislative session. Is it safe to say that water will continue to be a big topic of discussion at the Capitol come January?
I think it will in a different way. I think that there have been a couple of avenues or pathways created for folks out in the West Valley or Pinal County or the East Valley to get around that moratorium issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the topic of Colorado River is obviously huge.
Yeah.
And then the topic of groundwater remains to be seen whether they're going to come to an agreement, because they've been telling me for the last, I want to say, 2 years now that the Democrats and Republicans are so close to coming to a deal on rural groundwater, and they still haven't. So maybe this, you know, will just fizzle out.
And that's been a really controversial issue. It's like some folks in rural areas really want some kind of active management area solution.
Right.
And the governor seems inclined to do that in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of there are other folks both in the legislature and out who are like, no, thanks.
As you could probably guess, what it really comes down to is how much are we going to restrict people? And that is the difference between the Democratic plan and the Republican plan. How restrictive are we going to be with how much water people are allowed to use? And, you know, you would think that they would be able to compromise on that, but no.
And we will see if they maybe are able to compromise in 2026, huh?
Yeah, and I would love to talk about it. I'm excited.
All right, we'll have you back to do that.
That
is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk. Cameron, thanks as always.
Thanks.
The movie One Battle After Another opens on an immigrant detention facility on the U.S.-Mexico border. An armed revolutionary group that calls itself the French 75 is preparing a raid to free the captured migrants and transport them into the United States. Their plan works, but not before one of the French 75's operatives, a black woman calling herself Perfidia Beverly Hills, sparks a romantic connection with one of the military officials guarding the detention center. That official, a white colonel named Stephen J. Lockjaw, becomes obsessed with Perfidia, who is also in a romantic relationship with a fellow member of the revolutionary group, a man we'll come to know as Bob Ferguson. Colonel Lockjaw ends up catching Perfidia in the midst of another one of the French 75's operations, but he agrees to let her go if she agrees to spend a romantic evening with him. She does agree, and later, when she discovers she's pregnant, it's unclear whether the child was fathered by Lockjaw or Bob. 16 years pass. Bob and Perfidia's daughter, Willa, are living under assumed names in California. Lockjaw, fearful that his interracial relationship will be discovered, decides to hunt them down. One Battle After Another is a heavy favorite this awards season. It recently scored 9 Golden Globe nominations. But the movie's embrace of potent questions about the ideal form of resistance, imperfect revolutionaries, and the legacy of racism are jarringly timely, for some almost distractingly so. Joining me to talk about the film's remarkable resonance is Barbara Vandenberg, a member of the Phoenix Critics Circle, which we should say just awarded One Battle After Another its Best Picture Award. Barbara, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's talk about the timeliness of this film. How did that land for you? Did it serve your experience or did you find it distracting?
Oh, I didn't find it distracting at all. It absolutely served my experience. And furthermore, I think that One Battle After Another could be timely whenever it was made, right? Like One Battle After Another is a movie that could have been made in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and the aughts. And I think it would have felt just as relevant. I think it feels particularly relevant to a lot of people now because a lot of people now are just now paying attention to things like some of the themes that the movie is dealing with, some of the issues that it's dealing with, like authoritarianism and what civil resistance, civil disobedience means, what it means to organize within a community. So I think these are things that people, a lot of people are new to thinking about, but it's always been there.
Yeah. And we should give the context, I suppose, that it is loosely based on a Thomas Pynchon novel, which looked at sort of Reagan-era questions that were similar to this.
Yeah, yeah. Vineland by Thomas Pynchon. He's been wanting to do some kind of adaptation. Of course, he's adapted Thomas Pynchon before. Paul Thomas Anderson, Inherent Vice, is an adaptation of a Thomas Pynchon novel. And Vineland, I believe, came out in 1990, and it's about 1980s, set in 1980s, Reagan's America, but also flashes back to revolutionary efforts during Nixon's 1960s America. So, I mean, that right there shows you that these are themes and topics in America that are resonant across decades. So, yes, it's incredibly timely, and it's dealing with a lot of things that are in the news that we're discussing person to person, and that a lot of people who have not been politically engaged are starting to think about maybe for the first time, but that doesn't mean it hasn't always been there.
Yeah. Well, so I think we should also talk about the film's tone, because some people may be listening to this, hearing that it's about politics and anticipating a sort of broad satirical experience. But that's not necessarily the case, I don't think.
Yeah, sometimes the film is deadly serious and sometimes it's incredibly absurdist. It doesn't play everything with a straight face. I mean, look at Stephen J. Lockjaw, who's played by Sean Penn in the film, is an arch villain. He has a walk that's really distinct. He's wearing t-shirts that are like three sizes too small.
Yeah.
He's kind of a ridiculous, a little bit of a pathetic figure, but also very scary at the same time. This group that he – part of what drives the action in the movie is trying to figure out whether or not he's fathered this interracial child, because he wants to be part of this Christian white nationalist group that's very exclusive called the Christmas Adventurers Club.
Yes.
And the members of the Christmas Adventurers Club greet each other by saying, "Hail Saint Nick."
Yeah.
So it's absurdist.
Right.
But it's also serious, because there are Christian white nationalists and there authoritarian sort of military figures who are doing scary things. So, like, it's very serious, but he's striking in certain parts of the movie a very absurdist tone.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned Stephen J. Lockjaw and the way that he's portrayed. I think it's worth talking for a moment about the way the military is depicted in this film, because that is a very active conversation in cultural life right now, the way the military is being used vis-a-vis life in American cities. What did you make of Lockjaw and the depiction of the military more broadly?
I mean, it's nothing that I'm not seeing on social media feeds every day. I mean, truly, you're seeing a militarized presence in American cities currently right now, which makes the movie, not that you haven't seen that in the past, but it's also kind of a prescient movie. It came out in September, and so it had been filming, I should think, all the past year. And now you can't open your social media feed if you're connected, if you're paying attention, without seeing, you know, people in military garbs in American cities, ICE raids, rounding up individuals, arresting individuals without cause on the streets. And so, you know, I didn't see anything in that film that we're not seeing on social media feeds
right.
in real life.
I mean, that for me is where this whole question that we're talking about sort of comes from, is there are these sequences where you see military action on the streets of American cities and you could be watching CNN. It's like there is no difference between this fictional version of the story and what's actually happening. But I think we should also talk about the way the film ponders resistance, because we see a violent ideology-driven version of it in the French 75. We also see a more community-oriented underground representation of it. There's an immigration activist named Sergio St. Carlos in the film. What do you think Anderson wanted us to think about there?
I'm not quite sure, to be honest. I'm still muddling over that myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know that I would have characterized the French 75's actions as necessarily being violent. I mean, it is extreme in nature. They're doing things like invading's not quite the right word, but they're doing things like disrupting detention centers,
right.
and they're robbing banks. I guess that is, I mean, they're doing criminal actions, right?
Right.
Where it goes off the rails is there's a moment very early in the film, so this isn't a spoiler, but Perfidia does something that she shouldn't do. She harms somebody who is a civilian who she shouldn't be harming.
And it wasn't part of the plan.
So, you know, it's a powder keg. It's I see that there is danger there. It is a powder keg. Once you get guns into the equation, anything can happen, including harming innocent people, even when you think you're one of the good guys, even when you see yourself as part of a resistance. On the flip side, and I think the reason he's running away with things in these early critic voting circles and these early critic groups, Benicio del Toro's character is starting to win. Benicio del Toro is starting to win a bunch of Best Supporting Actor accolades from these critic groups. And I thought Sean Penn was going to run away with it. And that's been a bit of a surprise to me, but a happy surprise.
Yeah.
And I think it's because he's one of the hearts of the film.
Yes.
And Benicio del Toro's tact is entirely different in that he is a community organizer and he's bringing together groups of people to work together.
Well, I'm so sorry, Barbara. We are unfortunately out of time. There's obviously a tremendous amount to talk about in this film. Hopefully this conversation has made people want to check it out. Barbara Vandenberg, a member of the Phoenix Film Critics Circle, also manager of communications and events at ASU's Sidney Poitier Film School. Barbara, thank you.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the kitchen is a safe space, bringing back fond family memories in our latest edition of Eating Christmas.
But first, Mexican cartels have been diversifying their business models, and that may be impacting the price we pay for some products, especially at the grocery store. That's because of extortion or shakedown schemes the cartels are using on Mexican farmers and businesses, in some cases, very small businesses. Yoan Grillo is a journalist and writer based in Mexico City. He specializes in covering drugs and organized crime. In a recent piece for The New York Times, he writes about this concept of narco-inflation. Grillo joins me to talk more about this. And Yoan, when folks think about cartels, avocados, and other produce are usually not the first things that come to mind. So how is it that cartels got into this business?
Yeah, so the cartels, which are basically networks of paramilitary organized crime, really came together as drug trafficking organizations. But over the last 20 years, they have massively diversified to a whole bunch of crimes, and basically taking over a bunch of regular crimes, things like human smuggling, product piracy, taking over things like prostitution, and then getting into just shaking down regular businesses. And so this has really impacted all kinds of sectors, including agricultural sectors, but also street vendors and some big businesses as well, like mines and so forth.
And when you talk about these shakedowns, basically it works kind of like what we remember from the old mob movies, right? Like where, you know, somebody comes in and says, hey, you know, if you don't want to run into trouble, you got to give us some amount of money. Nice shop here. It'd be a shame if something happened to it.
Yeah, yeah, that's basically it. I mean, alongside that, there is a lot of very real violence taking place to remind people that they need to pay. So you see shops being burned down. You see people being, you know, shot dead, people being kidnapped and tortured and their bodies dumped. So you've got very, very real violence at the side of this. And, you know, this is one woman I talked to in the city called Cuautla, who described this. She was getting phone calls for a long time and not, you know, ignoring them. And then somebody came into her store and put a cell phone to her ear. And the person said, look, we know who you are. We know who your children are. We know what schools they go to. We know what their jobs are. We know who their partners are. And you're going to have to pay us $500,000 pesos or something very bad is going to happen to your family.
Is that generally the amount of money that business owners and others have to pay for this quote-unquote protection?
So the amount of protection money varies massively. So in some cases, it can be very small amounts. It can be, you know, a few dollars that people are taking regularly from people who have stalls on the side of the street. But it can be substantial. It can be 10, 20%, 30% of the income of a small store. And then what you see with a lot of businesses is become very organized by cartels, and things like avocado production or lime production or meat, you know, cattle farms, they'll do charging per kilo. So they'll say every kilo you sell, we get a cut. And they'll also often do these shakedowns at various links in the chain. So they might go and shake down people who have farms, but then also shake down people who have warehouses and transport companies. So they're almost acting like a shadow government in like trying to extract almost like a tax on this in many places in the chain. And then sometimes where you do have things like gold mines, silver mines, it can be very big, substantial amounts that they're paying as a form of extortion or protection to the cartels.
Okay, so if they're kind of acting as a shadow government, what is the actual elected government doing about this?
Yeah, I mean, this really puts the elected government, you know, it really raises the question about the role of the elected government in providing security for people. So there's been a security failure in Mexico that's gone on for the last 2 decades, really. At the same time, you've had this big cartel wars and the military fighting cartels. You've had so many crimes against regular civilians, so many murders, so many disappearances. And the government's really looking unable to deal with this. However, there has been now some effort by the government to respond to this. The current president, Claudia Sheinbaum, she is responding to the general security situation and has been trying to reduce the murder rate. And according to the official numbers, it has gone down, although some opposition people say, well, although the official murder rate's gone down, the cartels are simply disappearing more people to cook the books, to cook the numbers that they're making there. But also there has been an effort, and we've seen even in the last few days, and since the editorial in the New York Times came out, we've seen some significant arrests of some cartel figures who are majorly involved in the crime of extortion, and a new law being approved.
Yeah, well, and as you write, you know, President Sheinbaum is generally pretty popular. Her approval ratings are generally pretty high. Seemingly, this is maybe one of, if not the issue, that can sort of put a kink in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Claudia Sheinbaum won on a very big margin. She beat the opposition candidate by like 2-1. However, there's also a sector of people who dislike the government very much, who consider them very corrupt. And this particular area of extortion is one thing, although it's a problem that has been going on for a lot of years with the crime cartels, they've expanded extortion a lot recently. And this is something which really affects people. You know, we say often that the two biggest things for people, two biggest issues for voters, is the economy and crime. But this is crime that affects your personal economy.
Yeah. So in addition to the very real personal and economic toll this is all taking on folks in Mexico, it also is seemingly having an impact on consumers in the U.S. In fact, there's a phrase for this, narco-inflation.
Yeah, absolutely. As well as seeing general price rises for a bunch of conditions around the world, this is adding to that as well. So if you have people who are growing limes and you have an organized crime group getting a 10, 20% tax on that, that price then goes into the limes as they sell in Mexico and as they arrive in a bar in New York. So you could be putting a lime into a cocktail. The same with avocados. You get these extra prices, this narco inflation adding more to the cost of living. And the cost of living, you know, has really gone up in Mexico. So this is also affecting a lot of people and angering a lot of people that might not be directly being extorted, but this is hitting their pocket as well.
Does it seem as though there's any optimism that this will end or decrease in large numbers anytime soon?
Generally, a lot of people, I feel, are quite pessimistic about the ability of the government to really deal with crime. And they can believe in the president for other reasons, but genuinely quite a lot of pessimism. However, personally, although I've covered this for 20 years and seen how, you know, crime has really taken hold here, I still want to keep that hope there. There is always hope.
Yoan Grillo is a Mexico City-based journalist and writer specializing in drugs and organized crime.
Good morning. You're listening to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. As the year draws to a close, we're sharing memories of Arizonans who passed away in 2025. We begin today with Ernesto Portillo, a renowned Spanish-language radio broadcaster in Tucson. Portillo's career spanned 50 years. He's remembered for his weekly Charlas Portillo, a Saturday morning segment on KXEW, where he reported the news and interviewed local leaders, including Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. Portillo first interviewed Chicano activist Raul Aguirre after Aguirre won a state Spanish language competition as a high schooler. Portillo later used his influence to help Aguirre create one of the first bilingual radio programs in the country. The two worked together for more than a decade before Portillo passed away earlier this year.
Of course, my mom listened to him. Everybody listened to his program daily and also on the weekends because he opened the mic to give advocates, activists, politicians a voice to talk to our community in Spanish about what's going on in Tucson, in the state, in the nation. He had a very commanding presence and commanding voice. He was very polite, respectful, perfect Spanish all the time. So I was thrilled to be interviewed by somebody of that magnificent dimension. So I met him in high school. I was a junior. When I was a sophomore in college, a friend of mine, Gustavo McGrew, and myself had started a group called MECHA, which is the Movimiento Estudiantil Chicano de Aztlán, a student movement that grew out of the need to activate the urban areas in support of the farm workers. So one day we are literally cruising in a little Carmanguilla. We were talking about, wouldn't it be great if we had like a radio station that catered to young Chicanos in Tucson and in a bilingual format, particularly catering to our musical taste and our social justice endeavors. Wouldn't that be great? And he, Don Ernesto Portillo, saw our vision, opened the door for us younger people, and we did exactly what we said we were going to do. We had editorial comments. We supported the United Farm Workers. We played music that no one played. He was Javier Solís, which is a famous Mexican crooner, to my little Joey La Familia, which is a king of the brown sound, right? In 1976, we were the first ones to institute a program that was so multicultural that we were able to weave this tapestry of music that encompassed all the people who live here in Tucson. And it was a huge success. And also, of course, his impact in the community. I mean, he served on boards, how he walked around the mainstream market, who sometimes was very derisive of what we did in Spanish or bilingually. Chicanos and Mexicans, we were invisible to them. And he would walk into a room and make sure that everybody knew who Ernesto Portillo was. And that's something that I've emulated, you know, that I refuse to be invisible.
Qué breve fue tu presencia en mi hastío. Qué tibias fueron tus manos, tu voz.
But he was in all measures, not just a broadcaster, but a journalist and also a civic leader that had a lot of very strong identity and in promoting also the fact that Mexican Americans, Chicanos, have always been an intricate part of the American society and life.
Sombras nada más, acariciando mis manos.
He was so Mexican that he died on Día de los Muertos.
Pude ser feliz.
Ernesto Portillo was 92.
And now it's time for the latest edition of our Tiny Desert Concert Series, Scorpion versus Tarantula. Has played hundreds of shows since the band's inception in 2008 here in Phoenix. It was started by L. Hotshot and Jay Bennett, who were in another band called The Paperbacks in Chicago. When they first moved to Phoenix in 2005, they couldn't find the rock scene. Eventually, of course, they found their place and other musicians to play with. Scorpion vs. Tarantula could be described as too rock and roll for punks and too punk for metalheads. Lead singer Elle Hotshot is known for her big hair and dramatic eye makeup and tendency to get right up in the audience's face. They've played in all types of places, from record stores to Crescent Ballroom, but their sound is probably best enjoyed in the comfort of a dingy dive bar. I spoke with Elle after Scorpion vs. Tarantula performed for us at the Ghost of Eats East Side Records in Tempe. And just a warning, they're a bit louder than the bands we usually feature in Tiny Desert Concerts, but I think you'll be tapping your foot by the end of the song.
We are Scorpion versus Tarantula, and this is Heart Like a Fist. Walking down the street like a loaded gun. She got an eye on you, she got an eye on you. She don't need love, she need a revolution. There's nothing you can't do, nothing you can't do. She's gonna shake, 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 shake down your soul. Shake, 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 shake rock and roll. Red hot energy, she ain't gonna set a grid. Coming up on KJZZ, music. What's the point? She got a heart like a fist. Ooh. She got a heart like a fist. She got a heart like a fist, baby. She got a heart like a...
I have to ask, there's a break in Heart Like a Fist where you say, perhaps jokingly, I'm not sure, music, does it really matter? What's behind that question?
I think that's just my snotty punkness coming out. I used to have a shirt that said, I don't care about music. Uh-huh. I had another one that said, I'm not a musician, way back when. I think it's just, you know, the snotty punkness and that, you know, what is the point of music? Is there a point? What is the point of anything? Mm-hmm. But I will say, if there's a point to any of it, that is this. Live shows, I think, especially after COVID, have been hard. A lot of venues have closed down. People don't go out as much as they used to. I will say this. If you really want to feel what's going on out there in the city, feel what's going on with a genre, or feel what's going on just in a scene, go see a live show. And it doesn't have to be ours, for sure. But go out there and support live music. There's so many great bands out there and so many ways that you can connect with others that don't involve a phone or don't involve sitting in front of a screen. It really, really will feed your soul, promise.
Amen. So when you started playing as Scorpion versus Tarantula, how do you remember kind of knowing that you had found the sound that you wanted to bring out to shows? Was it there right from the beginning, or did it take a little while to find it?
I think I can't speak for everyone in the band, but I can say for me, it's a lot about how, for me, it's all about a performance. This is a performance for people. Mm-hmm. It's a performance. I'm not up there with my music stand and my notes and my lyrics. I'm not here to talk about things I don't know anything about. I'm here to talk about love and loss and defeat and low self-esteem and fighting through everything. And if I can project that to an audience and I feel that electricity back, I know that what we're doing is true and real.
So those themes that you are saying you're trying to express in the songs, as well as through the performance of the songs, are those themes you found yourself always writing about ever since you started writing? Or did you find those themes through this style of music, if that question makes sense?
It does. I think I'll try to answer it and let me know. I got into music very late in my life. My mom was divorced. She listened to a lot of light rock. I knew a lot. If you need the words to any light rock song, I've got you covered. So it wasn't until very late in my life that I started getting into this kind of music. A friend of mine gave me a Johnny Thunder CD. I threw it in my car, and I almost drove into a tree. And I thought, this is what I want.
So if I'm hearing you right, prior to that moment of getting that Johnny Thunder CD, you didn't even think of yourself as a songwriter.
No, absolutely not.
Uh-huh. Okay, okay. Were you writing about these ideas or these feelings in another form, or was it hearing that music that made you just kind of alchemize this energy into music?
I love to perform, and I like to be on stage. Uh-huh. I thought at first I wanted to be a drummer, and I bought myself a drum kit again in Chicago. I went to a guy's house. He said, come on in. There are a lot of boxes in the house, no furniture. I'm pretty sure it was stolen, but not really. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say it was. Got home, started drumming, and started playing with some people, and then thought, wait a minute, what am I doing? I don't want to sit behind here. Uh-huh. So I started performing, and I think that's when it started to come out. I think I'm naturally – I like to write. I have been a writer in my career, so I think that all kind of came naturally. And I think from a performance standpoint, it's the two put together that works for me.
Was there any early song that you wrote where you felt like you really got to that honesty you were just alluding to, that writing what you were really feeling, writing what you know, and you felt like, yes, this is my voice as a songwriter?
There's a song in there called My Own Worst Enemy, and it's a lot about being your own worst enemy. I wish I could, but I can't. And I wish I would, but I won't. A lot about self-esteem and how we kind of beat ourselves up over things.
I know I can't, but I wish I could. Yeah, 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 yeah. I know I won't, but I wish I would. Yeah, 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 yeah. Why do I have to be?
When I wrote that, suddenly I was like, okay, I feel okay about this. And you know what? I'm not the only one going through this.
So I have to say, Elle, something that's very interesting to me about what you're describing there is these are very tender feelings. You're talking about insecurity, love, loss. These are feelings that I think of as like soft, delicate. And yet your music has this really like big rock sound, this very driving style. You have a huge stage presence. You got the eye makeup going. You know, you got like the spikes on your wrists and everything. I have the sense that that contrast is interesting to you, the kind of like hard exterior, soft interior. Am I reading that correctly?
That no one's ever said that before, and I love that. And I think there is... I think sometimes to have those type of emotions, I'm a sufferer of depression. I know a lot of people are. When you feel that depressed, it's very easy to tuck into yourself, to close all the shades, close the doors down, and say, I don't want anything to do with anybody. I don't want to come out. What I feel is very therapeutic for me is to put on the makeup. Music is a very primal thing. Emotions are very primal. The way we interact with each other is very primal and cultural. Bringing that out, especially those type of emotions, and owning them with makeup and spikes and saying, you know what, this may be happening to me, but I can still be strong. I can still put it out there, and you're getting me.
Well, Elle, thank you so much for this conversation. Let's take a listen to one more of your tunes. What are you going to take us out on?
Sam, appreciate it and appreciate all that you and your team is doing. We're going to take you out on Short Leash.
You can find a video of Scorpion versus Tarantula's full performance, as well as the rest of our Tiny Desert concerts, on KJZZ's YouTube channel. You're listening to the show.
Choking on your
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Growing up in rural Arizona, Phoenix storyteller Christopher Hooper spent a lot of time in one particular room of the house. Here is the latest essay in this year's Eating Christmas series.
I grew up thinking the holidays lived in the kitchen. The smell of bacon sizzling, cinnamon rolls just ready to come out of the oven, and laughter that left tears on your face. My first memories were at my grandparents' house in my birthplace of Baghdad, Arizona. My mom had me 4 days after her 17th birthday and went off to nursing school in Phoenix. So I lived with my grandparents, three uncles, and an aunt. They called me Chrissy Toy. I was special, the first of the next generation. My grandmother, Marvella, was Texas to her core, and my grandfather, Chick Jr., was from Oklahoma and was kind and steady as a rock. Every Sunday, she made black-eyed peas, ham hocks, and cornbread that my grandfather would crumble into a bowl of buttermilk while he read the newspaper with me on his lap. Most kids had picture books. I had the classifieds and the obituaries. I started my life raised by Southern folks who still remembered the Depression in the way they would leave nothing but bone on a piece of fried catfish. During the holidays, when we would all come together, the men watched sports while I was in the kitchen with the women. I picked herbs from the backyard of my grandma, watched pies cool on the windowsill, and shared snacks with our little black poodle named Satan. He was my first best friend. And some people wonder why I turned out gay. The last Christmas we spent together before I left my grandparents, I remember my Aunt Ricky pressing her face to the window and whispering, "I see Santa. I see Rudolph's nose. Do you see it?" And I thought I saw it. She wanted me to believe, and I did. After my mom got married, we moved to Phoenix to live with my new stepfather. And life got complicated. My stepfather was an alcoholic. Holidays were the one time that he was on his best behavior. And my mother tried to make every holiday something to remember. When I was 8, my mom, Ruby Fay, taught me to fry chicken and make biscuits like a true Southern lady. And I soon was making full meals for everyone. The kitchen became the safe room when the rest of the house felt like it was going to explode. At 16, I moved out on my own and I wrote my grandmother a letter. And I told her I was gay. And she wrote back and she said she loved me no matter what and that I was special and always would be. When Alzheimer's took most of her memory, my aunt told me she was foggy most days, except when I called. She'd snap into focus, tell me stories about Texas and her five sisters and picking cotton as a small child in the Dust Bowl of Texas, then slip back into the fog when I hung up. The last time we talked, I was 36. She was in the hospital bed. She told me she was scared, and I didn't know what to say, so I went back to what always worked. "Grandma, tell me a story," I said. So she did. And she died the next day. I spent my whole life in restaurants and kitchens. I went to culinary school, and now I have a small baking business, making desserts that make people happy and remind me of those years with the people who loved me the most. every time I crack an egg, have my fingers in dough, smell that sizzling bacon and whip up some biscuits and gravy, they're all there. Satan, waiting for crumbs. My grandfather with his bowl of cornbread. My mother frying chicken. My aunt at the window pointing at Rudolph. And my grandmother making those black-eyed peas and telling me stories. The holidays aren't the same as they were. Everyone but my aunt and one uncle have passed on. But every holiday, I share that legacy with my husband and my friends. I go back to the place that has always been full of love and laughter, the kitchen. And when I cook, I'm never cooking alone. Thank you.
That was Christopher Hooper performing live on stage at Crescent Ballroom. You can find more Eating Christmas essays at kjzz.org.
And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. A reminder, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. If you want to subscribe to the show's weekly newsletter, it is called Radioheads. You can do that online as well. Just go to theshow.kjzz.org. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. It's not quite weekend yet. Have a great weekend when it comes, but have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.